I am Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. BBC Arts editor Will Gompertz believes that while creatives are often considered head-in-the-clouds types, they actually tend to be practical, business-savvy, fun-loving, and fulfilled. Gompertz should know. He's written Think Like an Artist and Lead a More Creative, Productive Life, a guidebook for turning your passions into a bankable career. We have this amazing capacity as humans that no machine will ever have, he says. We have the ability to have an idea and realize it. Hear what else Gompertz has to say about merging your creativity with your productivity in today's episode, drawn from Promax Europe 2019 in Amsterdam.
I'm the BBC's arts editor, and I have a particular interest in creativity. And I thought, it struck me that just hearing the boys speak just now, this is kind of what we're going to be talking about, isn't it? Today, sort of a relationship with technology and this sort of slightly awkward relationship we've got with technology, that on one hand it's like amazing and we can do extraordinary things, and the other hand it's kind of frustrating, and it's a worry, and sort of working out where we fit in the 21st century with AI and all the rest of it. And I just wanted to start with a story about some friends of ours who had a 16-year-old child doing, in Britain, doing his GCSEs, which is the exams you take at 16 to see if you can go further in education. And they're really, really important. And this child wasn't working very hard. This is about sort of 15 years ago. He wasn't working very hard, and his parents were worried that his life would be destroyed. They were very concerned. They said he was doing no work at all, just absolutely no work, and the teachers said it would be fine, and they weren't so sure. And eventually, when it came to the summer and getting the results, they were really concerned that this child was going to blow it all. But they figured that they had a university education, and so hopefully that would be all right. And this guy really had done jack shit, to be honest. He'd done no work at all. And anyway, so the results came in. And in those days, you'd get it by a letter. It was posted to you. And the parents were up at 6 o'clock in the morning to catch the letter as it was delivered by the postman. And they sort of caught it before it got to the mat. And they took it to the breakfast table. And they put it in the middle of the breakfast table. And they waited for their son to come downstairs, which he did at about midday. And their son comes downstairs, and he opens the envelope. He looks at the results. He goes, He folds the paper back up again. He puts it back in the envelope and goes off upstairs. And our friends are like beside themselves with worry. They want to know what they're in for. And eventually, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one of the boy's friends comes round, and he goes up to his room. And our mates decide to do that thing that no parent should ever do, which is to eavesdrop on the conversation their son is having with his mate. So they go outside. It's the summer. The window's open. There's loads of smoke coming out. Smells a bit like Amsterdam. And they let that go. And they hear their son's friend say to their son, "I did really well in my GCSEs. I got 8 A stars and 2 A's. And A is the very top of what you can get. A stars are the very top of what you can get. And a U, unqualified, is the very lowest." And they're in red. So he said, "I did really well with my GCSEs. I got 8 A stars and 2 A's." And our friend said, "Bloody hell, that is really good." And then they heard their son say, "Yeah, but I did much better than that." And suddenly it's like, my God, we didn't even know he'd taken 11 GCSEs. And they look to each other and they say, "We knew we had it in us." And the weight of the world is lifted from their shoulders. And then they hear their son say, "Yeah, with my GCSEs, I can spell beef and dude." So he had the most appalling GCSE results you can get. But he just thought it was really funny that he could spell these two words. And this was like 15 years ago. And what is interesting, and the reason I tell you this story, is because 15 years later, the A-star boy is in a small county town in the west of England doing property conveyancing the local estate agent. Well, Beef Dude is in LA writing movies and teaching at Berkeley. I mean, you know, it's just completely different. I mean, you might like being a conveyancing solicitor, but it's not like being in LA. And that is sort of sums up really, I think, where we are now and what people want and what we are as human beings. Because the whole A-star thing is all right, but anybody can get A-star because you can teach an algorithm to do it. But no algorithm, no computer is ever going to come up with the idea of looking at the results and thinking, I can spell beef and dude. So we have this amazing capacity as human beings that no machine will ever have. We have this capacity to step out of time and place and have an idea and realize it. It's extraordinary. And there's no other species on the world who has this ability. No computer, however large, it could be as large as several universes, will ever have the ability to think in an abstract way like that, to step out of time and place, to have an idea and then realize it. The ability, as you can see from Rodin's art there, the ability to think like an artist. So this is the most extraordinary thing we can do. This is the most extraordinary contribution we can make to the world. The question always is, though, the question for everybody in this room, the question for all of us all the time, is how do we do it? How do you have ideas that have some sort of value, whether that value is for society or the value is for business, whatever it might be, but how do you create ideas that have genuine value and impact? The answer lies with this guy, he's called Albert Rothenberg, and he's an American psychiatrist and psychologist. And he's spent his entire professional career trying to work out how it is that some human beings are able to use this creative facility we all have better than others. So he's worked with Pulitzer Prize winners and Nobel laureates to work out what it is they do that others don't to enable them to create these fantastic ideas. And he's come up with this notion of homospatial thinking. And homospatial thinking is based on an incredibly important truth when it comes to creativity. There is no such thing as an original idea. That sort of German romantic myth that you're walking down the street and suddenly out of nowhere, a light bulb goes on and you have this extraordinary idea. There is nothing like that ever happens. There is only ever ideas with origins. So Rothenberg worked out that all ideas stem from something old. And this is the idea of homospatial thinking. And here's how it works. You take something, I like art, by the way. Do you like art? Yeah, well, we're going to talk a bit about art. So take something really old, like Titian's Venus here, for example. So a 16th century painting, which is of a reclining nude, and everybody's very familiar with that as an artistic trope, as a genre. And artists would go and copy Titian's Venus in the museum because they admired him as an artist. And then along comes this guy, a guy called Charles Baudelaire. Now, here's the 19th century's answer to the internet. Charles Baudelaire comes along and he revolutionizes contemporary thinking. He comes up, he writes an essay in about 1863, which is about the painter and modern life. And in that essay, which is in the middle of Paris, when everything is going on, it's just been rebuilt by Baron Haussmann, you have the Impressionists just about to start their work, he writes this essay called The Painter and Modern Life, where he says that if you are going to be an artist, you cannot paint the past. Too much is going on. It's the Industrial Revolution. It's too exciting. That world is changing around us. We're in the most exciting city in the world. If you are going to be an artist today, you have to paint modern life. You have to paint everyday life. That was the provocation. So going back to Rothenberg and homospatial thinking, all ideas start with an origin. So the origin in this instance is Titian's Venus. There then is a disruptive force. So nowadays it could be the internet, but then it was Charles Baudelaire. Disruptive force forces contemporary thinkers to reconsider what they're doing and come up with something completely new. So here we have Manet's Olympia, patented in 1863, exactly the same year as Baudelaire made that paper. And all it is it's Titian's Venus. Again, he's completely copied Titian. It's got exactly the same composition. It's got a woman lying on a bed, on a couch, staring out at us with a maid in the background, exactly the same, except this painting revolutionized Paris and then would revolutionize the 20th century and would lead to modernism. It would change the aesthetics of the 20th century, this one painting. At the time when it was produced and it was hung up in the Grand Salon, it was considered to be outrageous and disgusting, and Manet was banned. And the big difference was Manet had painted everyday life. So as opposed to Titian's Venus, which is a goddess, Manet's Olympia is a prostitute. She's a hooker. She's a friend of Manet's that he met down the road. In fact, a few years after this, Manet died of syphilis. So in a way, it's a warning. You know, don't hang out with prostitutes, even in Amsterdam. So this changes art forever because of this notion of homospatial thinking, that an old idea has been disrupted by something new to create a completely different epoch. And that is the basis of all creativity. All ideas have origins. And there's also this extraordinary thing, and it applies now more than ever before, is the power of context. So if you go back again to this notion of what was going on in the early part of the 20th century and what you can do with context and how things are changing so rapidly across the media and different platforms and the power as creatives that gives you to play and transform and to create ideas of extraordinary value. So here we have Picasso. It's 1912 and it's in a direct response to Manet. After Manet comes Cézanne, and Cézanne starts looking at the world in different ways. And there comes Picasso, starting to develop this idea of cubism, which is looking at an object in several, looking at a three-dimensional object in several different perspectives, and then recreating it on a canvas. And those images started to become really complicated, but he wanted to paint everyday life, because that's what Baudelaire said. So he came up with this extraordinary idea in 1912, which is to create this notion of collage, something you think has been around forever, but actually in fine art terms, it was invented in 1912, by Picasso and Braque. And Picasso is in his studio, and he's making this painting of a cafe scene. And what you see is a rope as the frame, and it's a glass-topped table, and on the top of the glass-topped table is a newspaper. And he would often write clues into his paintings because they were quite difficult to read, and he wanted you to be able to understand them. So he writes a journal on top of the cafe table. And then, underneath the table, he slips in a chair. So you're seeing through the glass onto this chair. But the big change here is what you're seeing there, the chair, the chair caning, isn't painted by Picasso at all. That's just a bit of scrap paper. And this is a moment that revolutionizes the world. So Picasso had a bin, and in his bin, he had some old wrapping paper from a present somebody had sent him. And the wrapping paper happened to have this pattern of chair caning on. It's very typical in France. You can find it everywhere. And he gets this pattern out. He says, this would be great for my painting. And nobody had ever done this before. He takes something out of the bin, this bit of paper, and he flattens it out, and he glues it onto his painting. So the chair caning you can see there is just a bit of paper. It's not painted. It's just from his waste paper basket. And here's the amazing thing. Here is the power of context. That Picasso has taken something out of his bin, which was worthless and ubiquitous. You can get this stuff anywhere. He took it out of his bin. He moved it literally 3 feet, and he put it onto his canvas, and he turned it into something unique and valuable. It's exactly the same piece of paper. The only thing that has changed is its context. Something which was trash one moment becomes unique and valuable the next. And the weird thing about this, and what's so clever about Picasso's thinking, of course, is the paper of the chair caning is a trompe l'oeil. And we all know that art is an illusion. And you're looking through this glass at art that is an illusion, that is just a bit of scrap paper. And from this, the world changes. Again, from that same simple provocation that artists must paint everyday life. From that comes this notion of theft, of stealing. That if you are going to be having ideas that have origins, You have to be able to steal what already exists. You have to be able to take stuff and then represent it. And I suppose the greatest art theft of the 20th century was by Marcel Duchamp, who was a French artist who moved to Paris. And again, working with this notion of artists representing everyday life, he saw that what Picasso had done by taking an everyday object and making it into a painting. And then Duchamp asks four fundamental questions which changes art and aesthetics forever. This is why Damien Hirst's Shark is a work of art and not in the National History Museum. So Duchamp asks four questions that anybody in this room could easily ask, but four questions, weirdly, that had never been asked before this moment in 1917. The first question Duchamp asks is, why does art have to be beautiful? Up until this point, all art had been beautiful. So he goes and chooses something specifically that is anti-retinal, something that is not nice to look at, a urinal. The second thing he asks is, why does art have to be unique? Why does art have to be unique? So he goes and chooses something ready-made, something which pre-exists, this urinal. The third thing he asks is why does art even have to be made by an artist? Why can't I just choose something? Picasso did. Why can't I just choose something and call it art? So he decided that this urinal was a sculpture. And then the fourth thing he did, which changed everything forever and completely applies to the media landscape today, he asked a fundamental question that nobody had asked before. Up until this point, if you wanted to be considered an artist, you had to choose the medium first. So you had to choose either canvas or panel to paint on, or stone and wood to carve. You chose the medium, and only then could you express your feelings. And Duchamp said, that's nonsense. Art is about ideas. The idea should come first. And then after you've had the idea, you should choose the most appropriate medium through which to communicate it. And his idea was to challenge the very notion of what art was. And what better way to do that than in an object that would repulse East Coast America in the early part of the 20th century. So he sends this artwork in. There was going to be this exhibition of contemporary art, the biggest exhibition of contemporary art America had ever held. There was going to be no judges and no juries, an idea actually which had been stolen from the 19th century from Napoleon III. And there's going to be no judges and no juries, and everybody could show their art as long as they became a member of the society. And Duchamp was on the panel who organized this, and he thought he would test the liberal nature of that notion. So he sent in his urinal. He sent in a urinal as a work of art. He signed it R. Mutt, so not to give away his name. And he sent in his urinal, and he sent in his $5 to become a member of the society, and he waited for his artwork to be shown at this amazing contemporary art show. Except it wasn't. There was this huge row within the committee about whether they should show this artwork or not. And eventually, they decided not only not to show the artwork, but they smashed it to smithereens. That's how angry they were. Duchamp didn't mind. He just went and bought another one at the plumber's merchant. But it changes everything. Suddenly, the medium is less important than the idea. And when you change that around, and the idea becomes more important than the medium, and the idea dictates the medium on which you are going to communicate, it changes the game completely. And that, weirdly, had never been done until this moment. This leads to Dadaism, to surrealism, to punk. All these things can be directly connected to Duchamp asking four really simple questions just over 100 years ago. Four questions which could be applied, I'm sure, to media now and would transform media in the same way. But just nobody is asking them. That's the extraordinary thing about creativity, that we often just go around on autopilot and never stop and think, is that right? The other big thing about creativity, and particularly creativity in the 21st century, is this ability, this notion to be generous, to invite, to engage, as opposed to just broadcast. And I just wanted to touch on this amazing artist for a moment. She's called Marina Abramović, and she's fantastic. She was brought up in Tito's Yugoslavia, and she was actually drummed out of the country, and she ended up coming to Great Britain, and she worked as a postman, and her job was to deliver letters. But Marina Abramović has terrible English, and she has no sense of direction. so she could never post all the letters in time. So she made two piles of letters, one pile which was typewritten, and the second pile which was handwritten. And the pile which was typewritten, she threw in the bin, because they were bound to be bad news. And the ones which were typewritten, she delivered, because they were sent with love, which is a really beautiful idea. She got back to the office and was sacked, of course, but it's a nice idea. And she decided that was a piece of performance art. What she was doing was a piece of performance art. So she starts working with a German colleague and her lover called Ulay, and she starts developing this idea of using the body as an everyday object to communicate her artistic ideas. And you can imagine how much fun she had with this, can't you? And this is done in Britain, so to get some uptight British person to walk between two nude people must have been hilarious. You know, Ulay, let's stand closer together. And so she does this, and she becomes sort of quite well known. And eventually, in 2010, the Museum of Modern Art gives her a retrospective. Now, no performance artist has ever been given a retrospective in the history of museums before. It never happened before. So in 2010, MoMA gave her a retrospective, which is quite difficult with performance art, because on the whole, you kind of had to be there. And they said to her, Marina, what would you like to do? You know, within this retrospective, what would you like to do? And she said, I would like to sit in the atrium of this huge museum. I'd like to sit in the atrium on a small chair, as you can see here, with a table in front of me and an empty chair on the other side. And they go, all right, Marina, that's great. And they think, well, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people might come and sit on the other chair. She was going to do this. She said she's going to sit in this chair for 8 hours a day for 3 months, and she wouldn't move. She wouldn't move. She must have had a catheter in or something. So she didn't move. She sat in her red dress. And so they thought, oh, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people will come. And this just gives you a notion of what people want and need and feel about life at the moment, and how they perceive art as well. So anyway, she sat there, and there was that empty chair. But over 3 months, 2,000 or 3,000 people didn't come, actually. The curators were wrong. Just under 1 million people came and sat in that chair opposite Marina Abramović, with the art happening in the middle. If you go on YouTube and have a look, it's amazing. It had a profound effect, because people could communicate with her. There were queues all the way up Fifth Avenue, with superstars, Brad Pitt, all that sort of stuff, standing in the queue, waiting to sit opposite Marina Abramović. Some people would sit there for a few seconds. Some people would sit there all day, which really pissed off the rest of the line. And they communed with her. They couldn't touch her or talk to her or smile or anything like that. They just sat there and had a moment. And it was an extraordinary thing. And Marina Abramović made absolutely palpably clear to all of us, everybody in this room and beyond, that people want to communicate. They want to engage. They want to be invited in. And they will respond in their millions. Do go online and have a look at it. There's an amazing moment where Ulay, who she split up from, comes and sits in that chair. She reaches out and holds his hand, and it's extraordinary. You cannot be creative. You cannot have ideas of any value at all. In fact, you can't have an idea at all if you don't ask questions. Cézanne is probably the greatest artist of the modern era, and he gave us what is now the modern visual language of the 20th century. iPhones look like iPhones because Cézanne. And this is such an extraordinary story because it's such an easy question he asked, and yet he changed the world with a really, really powerful idea. Up until this point, where Cézanne is painting Mont Saint-Victoire in Aix-en-Provence, he lived on a farm, he looked out at this mountain the whole time. Up until this point, if an artist was painting a landscape, everything would be in focus. The houses, the horses, the hay, the people, everything would be in focus. And then the artist would say to the person buying the painting, this is what I see. And the person buying the painting would believe it, although it was a complete lie. When Cézanne looked out at Mont Saint-Victoire in the late part of the 19th century, he didn't say, this is what I see. He asked himself a question, and he said, what do I see? And when he looked out, he realized what he didn't see was everything in focus. What he actually saw in the middle distance was an overall design of geometric shapes and colors. So he started to paint that. He started to paint what he saw. So he started to remove visual information. He started to abstract information, to remove detail, to get to a broader overall truth. And in order for that to work, he created a grid of horizontal and vertical lines. You can see where the viaducts are horizontal and the major vertical line is the tree trunk. And the horizontal and vertical lines were to create a structure for his painting and a sense of breadth with the horizontal and depth with the vertical. So if you go and see this painting, it's in London, and you put your arm over the trunk, suddenly those branches look like they're hanging over Mont Saint-Victoire, 8 kilometers away. Remove your arm, and they're back over the artist's head. So Cézanne does this, and then this leads directly on to abstraction, the Bauhaus, Kandinsky, all those names which are so famous, all come because one person asked one question in the 19th century, which transformed the visual language of the world. One person. So ideas are incredibly powerful. This is small. This is one person sitting on a crappy little stool in the rural France, looking at a mountain. Changes the world. Because that picture is able to go into the world, people see it and they respond to it, and everything changes. It reminds me of this notion of asking, of a conversation I had with J.J. Abrams, who is fantastic. He's young, he's good-looking, he's unbelievably talented, and therefore, in my opinion, a total bastard. And I was talking to him, this is when he was about to reboot Star Trek. Do you remember that? It was about 5 or 6 years ago. And I said to him, you know, are you not worried, JJ, about upsetting all those Trekkies? You know, there's hundreds of millions of Trekkies out there. Here you are rebooting this thing they love dearly. Are you not concerned that you might screw it up for them? And he said, to be honest, I never think about people watching the movie. I just think about the movie and making something which is true. And he says, the way I make a movie, and I don't think about anybody else, is I just ask myself a series of questions. How do I get Captain Kirk from this bit of the Starship Enterprise to this bit? And when he's there, who does he meet? And if it's Spock, what do they say? And if they have an argument, what happens next? And he says, I interrogate the idea to such an extent that by the end of it, I've got myself a shooting script. And of course, what he was describing was the Socratic method, the method that Socrates developed in ancient Greece, which was to investigate the truth to such a degree, investigate a question to such a degree that you eventually arrived at the truth. It's an incredibly powerful, emphatic way of having an idea. To ask and ask and ask. It's also bloody annoying. So annoying that Socrates was put to death by the Athenians for corrupting the minds of the young. And yet here we are in this painting by David with Socrates about to die. So Socrates is about to die and he's being handed a cup of hemlock. And Plato's at the end of the bed. He's very sad. Everybody else is very sad. Everybody else has got no energy. And there we are, looking at Socrates, who has still got bags of energy. He's still asking questions. He's still interrogating the truth. And here is the thing about being a human being. It is when we are being creative, it is when we are asking questions, it is when we are intellectually interrogating a problem, that is when we feel closest to the life force. It is the moment we feel most human. So although Socrates is about to die in about 90 seconds' time, he is still more alive than anybody else in that room will ever be. That is creativity personified. And I look at that, and then I think about this. And this is a schoolroom, which is how people are taught still, unbelievably. And this is also how we are at work. This is how most of us go about our lives. We are not going about with our finger in the air saying, yeah, but. We're going along saying, yeah, okay. And yeah, okay never creates anything. Yeah, but can change everything. And I suppose the only way to do that, of course, is to break all the rules. You know why I put this picture in? Just a fabulous hairdo, I think. Good old Shakespeare, he knew how to wear it, you know. Be proud and be bold. That's all I can say. So Shakespeare is amazing, right? So Shakespeare illustrates for us a high point in creativity. So 400 years ago, Shakespeare wrote 37 plays. 37 plays which are still performed in every country across the world 400 years later. So I think we can agree this is a high point of creativity. He wrote those plays with other people. Creativity is something which is always collaborative. It's never singular. And he does this amazing thing. But we all learn about Shakespeare. We all learn about how great he is. But very few of us are told how he actually did it. And the way Shakespeare created 37 plays, which were so powerful that they're still performed nearly half a millennium later all over the world, the way he did it was by breaking a bunch of rules. As Picasso said, the act of creativity is an act of destruction. You have to destroy to create. Something has to break to make something new. And Shakespeare broke the English language. For Shakespeare to write those plays, he had to invent 3,000 words or phrases which simply didn't exist before. Words which had never in the lexicon before. He was brave enough to put into his plays and transform the British language and the way people perceive the world. He broke the rules. You know, if you're a child in school and you're writing an essay about Shakespeare and you make one word up, you know, you're straight into beef dude territory. You know, but nothing's created without breaking rules. And the other thing, which I discovered by talking to a lot of artists, is this notion of failure. And I know that nowadays we think failure is sexy. And, you know, lots of people often quote Beckett, which is fail, fail again, and fail better. What people don't quote is what happens at the end of the story, which is suicide. I know, people never mention that, I don't know why. So the thing is, and here's the truth, there is no such thing as failure. Failure simply does not exist. Failure is a notion that is both subjective and temporal. And I wanted to give you an illustration of that very thing by showing you an artist called Bridget Riley, who is one of the best artists living on the planet, in the world today. She's an amazing person. At the age of 16, she could paint like this, which is pretty amazing. She had the most remarkable facility. At the age of 30, she was painting this, which is frankly boring. So Bridget Riley was 16 years old. She had this fantastic ability. She went to art school. She opened a studio. And she loved the impressionists. And she loved color. And she loved figurative art. And here she is painting a landscape after Seurat. And that she got to 30. And everybody said, Bridget, you're boring. You're not making work which is at all interesting. You're just doing pastiches of work we've seen 1,000 times before. You're 100 years out of date. And she got very upset, and she was told she was a failure. And at that same time, her lover of many years decided to end their relationship, and her father had a terrible car crash. So Bridget Riley is kind of at the end. She thinks it's over. She's really sad. She thinks terrible thoughts. And she's also furious with her lover. So she gets out a canvas from the studio, a blank canvas, and she just paints the whole thing black. And she says, you know, I'm going to send this to him and show that life is not just black and white. It's more nuanced than that. It's about color. And it's about the impressionists. I'm going to send this to him. And she goes to bed, having had a couple of gins and tonics. She gets up in the morning, bit of a headache. And she looks at this black canvas. And she looks at this Seurat painting she's got hanging in her studio, or her copy of a Seurat painting, rather. And she realizes the black canvas doesn't actually say anything at all. So she gets out some white paint. And she just draws a line about a third of the way up the black canvas, just this line of white paint. So she creates two forms. And then she looks at this Seurat painting, she looks at the curvature and the shoulders of those hills, and she gets that white paint and she creates that curve. Look, I'll show you here. She creates that curve on the white painting. So she then creates three forms and she animates all three forms. So she went to bed, this woman, just thinking she was going to end it all. That she was a failure, that she was useless. She wakes up in the morning and she creates this, and she changes the visual arts in 1960. She creates op art. She creates a whole language that she didn't know existed. This becomes the visual signature of the 60s and the 70s. This is a woman who 24 hours earlier was thinking about ending it all. And the point about creativity, the point about ideas, they don't always come easy, and they often run counter. There's often a plan B. They run counter to what you think. This is a woman who loved color and figuration and becomes the most famous black and white abstract painter in the world. She eventually found her voice. And this is the thing, the exciting thing, I think, about creativity, is each and every one of us has a slightly different way of looking at the world. So we are 99.9% like identical, but every one of us looks at the world slightly differently. So if I asked you to describe that tree in 20 words, nobody would come back with exactly the same configuration of 20 words to describe that tree. Each and every one of us looks at the world slightly differently. And if we can find the way it is that we look at the world, which is unique, then we unlock an enormous creative well within ourselves for which we can have ideas and make valuable contributions. So here's somebody, for example, who's quite good at painting but has not found their voice yet. He goes to Braque and Picasso's studio and looks at cubism and starts to look at that same motif as a tree and break it down. Still hasn't found his voice. Breaks that tree motif down even more, using more tonally refined colors. Still hasn't found his voice. Breaks that tree down even more. This is a process going over years, trying to work out what is my voice. How do I express myself in a way that is unique and comprehensive? And then eventually, boom, does that. It's Mondrian. He eventually works it out, what it is that only he can say. And what's so great about this image is it's a direct riff on Cézanne. This is 1921. For Mondrian, he wants to boil painting down to the essence. So it starts with Cézanne saying, is this what I see? Abstracting visual information to get to a truth, to create a structure of horizontal and vertical lines, to make sense of the painting, and then just blocking it with geometric shapes and colors. This is the extreme end of that, 40, 50 years later, where Mondrian's got the black and the horizontal and vertical lines represent all the opposites in the world, good and bad, hot and cold, male and female. And then he's just dealing with the three primary colors, always asymmetrical, never symmetrical, always asymmetrical. And three primary colors are there to express all the emotions in the world. He's Dutch, not that emotional. He really wasn't that emotional, to be honest. And that is the aesthetic, of course, of the Bauhaus, of modernism. It has come directly from Cézanne. But nobody else could paint like that. He had a partner called Theo van Doesburg, who also painted like this, but would do diagonal lines. And they fell out over it. They actually fell out over the fact that van Doesburg did diagonal lines, because Mondrian thought that was not true. So he had this very unique way of looking at things that enabled him to change the world, to create an aesthetic which you can see all around you every day. Then I wanted to finish on this one notion of enterprise. Because weirdly, I think enterprise is maybe the most artistic thing anybody can do. There's this fallacy that artists are somehow bohemians who live in ivory towers who are not interested in enterprise. And the truth of the matter is artists are the most enterprising individuals on the planet. We're in Amsterdam. You know, this is the home of the Van Gogh Museum. The Van Gogh Museum exists because of the enterprise of his brother's wife to make Van Gogh famous. But when he was down in Arles making those paintings, he was doing so as a business, working with his brother. He was incredibly enterprising. He might have been starving because he spent all his money on paint, but he was incredibly enterprising. And so Andy Warhol sums it up beautifully, of course, this notion of good business is the best art. That creating something out of nothing, having an idea and being able to employ people is an extraordinary thing. But for artists, they have to be enterprising, because if they can't establish how they are different than somebody else, nobody's going to buy their work. They have to be their own mini brands. I love this from Rubens, the great Baroque artist who lived in Antwerp. He was a door-to-door salesman. He'd go around the great houses of Europe saying, what you need there, Duke this or Queen that, is you need a three graces on your staircase. He'd then go back to the boys in Antwerp who were running his factory and say, chaps, knock us up another three graces for the Duke in Austria. And that's what they would do. This is fantastic by Gilbert and George. Make the world believe in you and then make them pay heavily for the price. But this is the guy I want to end on. because this guy is extraordinary. He's called Theaster Gates. He's African-American. He was brought up in Chicago. He was a ninth child. He has eight older sisters from a poor family. They had to share food among the community. Theaster goes to school, he does well. He goes to college, he does well. He becomes a tutor at college on town planning. And at the weekends, he likes to make pottery. He makes bowls and plates. And then every month, he'd go to a county fair and sell those bowls and plates. But people would say to Theaster, you know, you're charging $5 for that bowl, but can I give you three? And he'd say, but I made these things with my head, my hand, and my heart. I'd rather give them to you than haggle. So eventually he thinks, I'm going to stop doing this. And he decides, and they're not very good, to be honest, his bowls and plates. I've seen them. They're not great. And he decides to have an exhibition in a space no bigger than this stage. And he has an exhibition of all his bowls and his plates. Except he doesn't say they're by Theaster Gates. He makes up a story. He says they're by a guy called Soji Yamaguchi. And Soji Yamaguchi is a conflation of two names, Soji Hamada, who was a great ceramicist, and Yamaguchi, an area in Japan where ceramics are taught. He put those two names together and figured the Americans would never work it out, which, of course, they didn't. So he has this show, and he creates a backstory for Soji Yamaguchi as well. He has a backstory for Soji Yamaguchi. This is his great Japanese master who came to America to work with the black clay of Mississippi, fell in love with an African-American woman, eventually took her back to his village in Japan to show her where he was brought up, and then tragically, but very conveniently for Theaster, died in a car crash. And so he has his show, and do you know what? Every single object in that show sold out within 2 hours, and nobody haggled a cent of anything. And he wasn't charging $4 or $5 for the same plates and bowls. He was charging $400 and $500. And eventually the art world found out what Theaster Gates had done. And they came up to Theaster and said, Theaster Gates, you are fantastic. You're great. You're an artist. And he said, oh God, am I? Really? Amazing. So this guy who teaches town planning went and bought a house on the south side of Chicago, which, as he told me, is somewhere you only move from and not to. It's a murder capital of America. That's the name it's got. It's a death a day. It's 99% African-American, and there is a form of segregation going on there, and Theaster Gates is trying to change that. So he buys this place for not very much money. It's been boarded up for 20 years, and it's full of rubbish. It's full of detritus, the sort of stuff, frankly, you and I would put on a skip. But Theaster decides this stuff's got some sort of intrinsic value. It's got a story. So he gets an old fire hose, which has been lying in the basement with dust and rat's urine on it, and he recoils the fire hose. He gets the bottom of a drawer, and he taps the fire hose to the bottom of the drawer, and he gets some old balustrading, and he creates a frame. So this is all crap he's taken out of his house that you and I put in a skip. So he just creates this thing because he thinks these objects have a story to tell, and he sells it as a work of art. This is just rubbish which is in his house. He sells it for a work of art, and he sells it for $150,000. I know, it's amazing. And he does it again and again and again and again. Theaster Gates is now considered to be the fifth most powerful person in the art world. This guy who can't make pots and just uses trash to make art. It's quite extraordinary. With the money, he takes the money, and then he rebuilds another house on the south side of Chicago. He takes the guts out of the house. He sells it to the art world. He says he can't believe how wet rich folks get about this stuff. He sells it to the art world. He takes their money, and he builds renovates another house within the south side of Chicago and gives it to the local community. So there's a black cinema house, a black reading house, black music house. All of them are full of facilities and content for people to work with. One piece by piece is going through the south side of Chicago and changing that space and that place, working with Rahm Emanuel. One man is doing that on his own through having one idea that these objects have value, objects that you and I would throw away. This is happening right now in front of us. This is happening in Chicago. It's quite extraordinary. So I suppose what I'm saying is there are problems. You have problems at work. We have problems to solve. There are problems in the world. Look at them. Global warming, terrorism, and migration, probably the biggest issue we need to solve. The thing is, and the message is, whether it applies to your work or more broadly what's going on in the world, is that we all have the capacity to come up with ideas of value which will change the world for the better. as long, and this is absolutely fundamentally important, as Theaster Gate showed us, we are willing to believe that we are all artists. Thanks very much.
Paige Albaniak is editorial director of Promax. Andres Trujillo, Promax's social media and community manager, produced this podcast. Video Helper provides the music. Digital content producer Kayla Marie Hardaway contributes to Daily Brief. Promax has rebranded to just Promax, so you can find us on Promax Global on Facebook and Promax_Global on Twitter and Instagram. You can also always reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.